military cooperation between Iran and Russia on the upswing. The top Iranian general says that the two countries will work together to eradicate terrorism in Syria. Britain reports a further 179 coronavirus-related daily deaths and more than 49,000 new cases. A massive flooding and landslides caused a trail of destruction in India and in Nepal, leaving over 150 people dead and dozens missing in both countries. Well, welcome to the studios near the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Tehran and Moscow will continue their strategic cooperation to help establish sustainable security in the region. That's according to the chief of the General Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri. The top general has met with senior Russian military officials during an ongoing visit to Russia. He says the two sides discussed expanding cooperation and fighting international terrorism, which has been a top concern in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and the Caucasus region. Bagheri also talked about the future arms contracts between Tehran and Moscow. The Iranian general said that all these issues would be discussed in detail in a joint military commission scheduled in 3 months in Tehran. The Israeli regime has reportedly allocated a budget of some $1.5 billion to prepare its military for potential attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities. Israeli media say that the budget is slated to be approved by the regime's cabinet in November. The reports say the budget includes funds for various kinds of warplanes, spy drones, and arms needed for such attacks. Last week, Israel and its main backer, the United States, renewed their military threats against the Islamic Republic over its nuclear activities. Iran maintains that its nuclear program is peaceful and subject to rigorous international inspections, while Israel allows no such checks and possesses hundreds of nuclear warheads. Tehran has also repeatedly warned Israel and its allies against any kind of military adventurism, saying that such a move will receive crushing response. Author and journalist Robert Fantina believes that Israel is an apartheid regime that continues to violate international law with the support of the United States.
Israel doesn't see any guilt in what it does. Israel, like the United States, considers itself above the law, and the United States paves the way for it to do so. Israel has assassinated nuclear scientists in the past. As you mentioned, it's bombing Syria. It's a rogue nation. It's an apartheid nation, and it doesn't care to follow international rules. Unfortunately and tragically, the global community has allowed it to get away with its crimes against humanity and its violations of international law for decades. This needs to change. So it is the United States and Israel that are continually violating international law. The government of Iran wants to protect its people from threats, and certainly the threats that the United States and Israel present are great and real. And the Iranian government has not only the right, but the responsibility to do what's necessary to protect its people.
Palestinians have held a sit-in and rally in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners in Israeli jails. The prisoners have gone on a hunger strike in protest to the Israeli authorities' brutal treatment. Mona Kandil reports from the occupied West Bank.
The families of six Palestinian prisoners who have gone on an open-ended hunger strike call on human rights organizations and the Palestinian leadership to speed up their moves and save the lives of their sons, whom some are literally fighting death in Israeli hospitals amid serious deteriorating health conditions. They also hold the Israeli regime fully responsible for their lives. To this end, Palestinian organizations concerned with prisoners' affairs organized a sit-in at Ramallah's Al-Manara Square with the participation of the prisoners' family members and relatives. Miqdad Al-Qawasmi has been protesting for over 90 days and Kaid Al-Fasfus has been on hunger strike for nearly 100 days.
His lawyer, who had visited him at the Bir Zalai Hospital, said Kaid's life is in danger. Doctors say he's experiencing extreme physical weakness. We call on human rights organizations to take an immediate step to save my brother's life before we receive any bad news.
In addition to the six detainees who are on hunger strike, some 400 prisoners affiliated with the Islamic Jihad movement are continuing their mass hunger strike, began over a week ago. The move comes in refusal of the punitive measures imposed on them following the escape of six Palestinian prisoners from Gilboa prison last month. Israeli soldiers rearrested the six prisoners but began to punish thousands of other Palestinian prisoners.
We are here today to support the hunger-striking inmates. The prisoners are not alone in their struggle. Rallies like this are held in other Palestinian cities to let them know that they are not alone.
As usual, Israeli prison authorities refuse to deal with the hunger-striking prisoners' demands. Observers say Israel reaches a deal with the prisoners only when hunger-striking detainees are on the verge of death. Tensions are boiling in the occupied West Bank over Israel's mistreatment of the hunger-striking prisoners. The Palestinian people here are concerned about the deteriorating health conditions of Kaid al-Fasfus and Miqdad al-Qawasmi, praying that the two inmates' lives could be saved before it's too late. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Deadly day in the Syrian capital. A twin bomb explosion has ripped through an army bus in Damascus, leaving 14 personnel dead and several others injured. The bombs went off as the bus was crossing under a bridge during the morning rush hour. A third bomb was defused. There had been no immediate claim of responsibility. Iran and the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah condemned the deadly incident. Tehran said the blind and cowardly acts of terrorism are doomed to fail and will not affect the steadfastness of the Syrian people to free their country from terrorists. Syria has experienced a number of gun and bomb attacks, especially after the army took over the last militant bastion near the capital in 2018. Political analyst Marcus Papadopoulos says that a coordinated attack in Syria shows terror groups, including Daesh, are receiving training from Western forces.
My analysis of the attacks in Damascus shows that they were very well coordinated, very well planned, and they were brutally executed, which demonstrates that some very influential players in the world have been training these terrorist cells. So even though the advances of the Syrian army, the liberation of most of Syrian soil, cannot be rolled back now by the terrorist groups and their patrons, such as America, Britain, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, nonetheless, this is a way of the terrorists and their supporters inflicting losses on Syria. It is a way of keeping the fight going. It is a way of warning the Syrian people that they are not entirely safe in their towns and cities and villages throughout Syria. So I believe this attack is more of a psychological attack on the Syrian people.
The United Nations Children's Agency says that the crisis in Yemen has just hit another shameful milestone, as at least 10,000 Yemeni children were killed or maimed since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in Yemen in 2015. Abdulatif Al-Washali has more.
Human suffering in Yemen has reached some staggering levels, especially for children. UNICEF spokesperson James Elders said in a press briefing following his recent visit to Yemen that at least 10,000 Yemeni children were killed or maimed since the onset of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, and many more child deaths and injuries go unrecorded by the UN.
Children have been the most affected section of the Yemeni society during the Saudi-led war on Yemen, as the Saudi coalition's warplanes target residential areas, killing children. The UN figure is not accurate, and we have some other reliable figures showing that the number is higher.
11 million children need humanitarian assistance, Elder said, including 400,000 suffering from acute malnutrition. Ali is 2.5 months old. He is suffering from severe acute malnutrition, and he may die if he did not get a proper treatment.
The real number of children suffering from severe malnutrition exceeds 1 million. The situation is deteriorating due to the continuing food crisis in the country and lack of medicines for children. The aid we receive from the UNICEF and other organizations is not enough to cope with the catastrophe.
Yemen is on the brink of famine and was described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis as a result of the years-long Saudi war and the blockade.
More than 6 years after the start of the brutal Saudi-led war, the endless suffering of Yemeni children continues as they are deprived of their most basic needs such as food and medicine. This has made Yemen the most difficult place in the world to be a child. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Britain has reported over 49,000 new coronavirus cases and 179 related deaths in the past 24 hours. The country's total caseload now stands at over 8.5 million, which is the highest in Europe. Britain has the fourth highest COVID death tally globally, with more than 139,000 fatalities. As winter approaches, hospitals are likely to face severe pressure as the number of patients is on the rise. So far, more than 45 million Britons have been fully vaccinated against the virus, but the country continues to witness a relative surge in infections. Massive flooding and landslides have left a trail of devastation in India and in Nepal. Over 150 people are dead and dozens missing in both countries. The floods triggered by incessant rains have inundated acres of farmlands, residential areas in two Indian states, Uttarakhand in the north and Kerala in the south. Rainfall has exceeded 400 millimeters, with Indian Army personnel conducting search and rescue operations in some regions. Officials in Uttarakhand have said that locals are faced with a series of problems, as crops have been destroyed and roads are waterlogged. In neighboring Nepal, 77 fatalities have been recorded. Dozens more remain unaccounted for. Heavy to very heavy rainfall is forecast for the coming days. Hundreds of non-local workers are fleeing Indian-controlled Kashmir after they were targeted by a series of shooting incidents. Since the beginning of October, more than 30 people, including Indian armed personnel, civilians, and pro-freedom fighters, have died in different incidents across the troubled Himalayan region. Our correspondent Shana Butt reports from Kashmir.
Fear is growing in Indian-controlled Kashmir following a series of shooting incidents across the region that killed around a dozen civilians, including four non-local workers. The fear doubled among the non-local residents after police said non-locals should reach army camps and police stations. Dhananjit Kumar has been working in Kashmir for the last 12 years. Each year he stays here for 6 months and returns home with his hard-earned money. But this year, he's moving ahead of time.
My family back home is worried. They insisted upon my return. I have worked for so many years here, but I have never seen such chaos. The situation here has never been right, but we were never involved. This time, it's different.
Dhananjit Kumar and many like him are on the move, while many others have sought police protection till they manage a way out. Following the deadly October violence in Kashmir that resulted in more than 33 killings, which included 9 Indian Army personnel, 11 civilians, and 13 pro-freedom fighters in different incidents, the administration issued an alert across the war-weary Indian-administered Kashmir. Intelligence reports warn of attacks on power projects, emergency landing strips, and other government infrastructure. New Delhi has installed additional security forces across Kashmir after intelligence reports warned of more attacks.
We are doing our best to neutralize the terrorists who are behind the civilian killings. We have killed around 11 terrorists in October till now, and we'll do our best to ensure the safety and security of our people. It's not a security lapse. The targets were soft, and now we beefed up and more vigilant.
After India stripped Kashmir's autonomous status in August 2019, people of the region were promised development, prosperity, and greater opportunities. However, media reports suggest the situation in the region has slipped from bad to worse due to the absence of local political activities and implementation of rules and laws without taking people of Kashmir on board. Kashmir is a dispute between India and Pakistan since the partition of Indian subcontinent in 1947. The two have fought wars over the territory and claimed the region in full, but rule it in parts. The fresh spate of violence in Indian-administered Kashmir is seen by many as a politically motivated action. People of Kashmir urge the world community to help resolve this geopolitical dispute between India and Pakistan before they engage in war and devastate the leftover lives. Shahana Butt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Muslims in Nigeria have taken to the streets in the capital Abuja to mark the birthday anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad. Danjuma Abdullahi has more in this report.
Thousands of Muslims marched through major streets of Suleja to mark the birthday anniversary of Prophet Muhammad. For members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, the celebration has been going on for a week because it was designated as the Unity Week by the late founder of the Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini.
We all believe that the Prophet is our Prophet, one Prophet, no any other Prophet apart from him. And he unites, he brought the Quran through Archangel Jibril, and he is the one that show us the path, the direction, and the way to follow. You can see the whole people in this town are now out to celebrate the birthday without any of us thinking that he will be paid.
Members of the Islamic movement said Muslims must unite to defeat the seeds of discord planted by enemies of Islam in the name of Shia-Sunni sectarian divide. They condemned the various terror attacks resulting in the killing of Muslims in Afghanistan and in Nigeria, which they said may not be unconnected with global arrogance to plunge the Muslim communities into chaos in order to steal resources. These incidents, the Islamic movement said, is the result of disunity, so Muslims around the world must unite.
When we unite together, we'll be very, very strong, and nobody can molest us, nobody can do whatsoever he want to us, want to do to us. Our unity will make the Islam to progress and to know our aim and to achieve our aim here and hereafter. In fact, this is the happiest moment to every Muslim Ummah in the world.
Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria recall that their leader, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, has always emphasized that unity among Muslims is about understanding each other and working together for the benefit of the larger Islamic Ummah. They said that although this is an auspicious occasion, it is still important to recall the 2015 Zaria massacre, where more than 347 of their members were killed. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
The U.S. Naval Base in the state of Maryland has been placed under lockdown amid bomb and shooting threats. Authorities with the base in Montgomery County say that personnel were put inside of a shelter after an anonymous caller said that there was a bomb near a building. Security personnel responded to the scene soon after. Officials at the Naval Base later tweeted that there was no indication of an active shooter on the premise, but that the bomb threat was still being investigated. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight.
Russia will do what it can to assist the United Kingdom and could potentially even come to the rescue amid problems linked to rising energy costs, the country's ambassador has suggested. Russia's ambassador to Britain, Andrei Kelin, also denied that Russia is withholding gas supplies, appearing to suggest commitments to increase supply will take time to take effect. The article you're about to hear has been written by Ben Hatton, a writer and journalist, a member of political staff of Press Association. The piece is titled, Russia Will Come to Rescue of UK If Needed During Gas Crisis, Ambassador Says. Russia will do what it can to assist the United Kingdom and could potentially even come to the rescue amid problems linked to rising energy costs, the country's ambassador has suggested. The Russian ambassador to the United Kingdom, Andrei Kelin, also denied that Russia is withholding gas supplies, appearing to suggest commitments to increase supply will take time to take effect. The Russian ambassador to the United Kingdom also said that it is his understanding that no decision has yet been taken in Russia as to whether President Putin will attend the COP26 climate conference being hosted in Glasgow from the end of October. Asked on BBC One's Andrew Marr show if Russia understands the pressures of gas supply and price increases on people in Europe and the United Kingdom, Andrei Kelin said Russia is following the situation, but appeared to play down the significance of the issues in the United Kingdom. However, he also suggested Russia will come to the rescue if needed. Mr. Kelin said, if it will be an opportunity, we will come to rescue. We will do what we can, of course, to alleviate difficult conditions which are now being created. The ambassador said Russia has increased gas supplies to assist Europe amid a global increase in prices, but also argued the country could do more if the controversial Nord Stream 2 pipeline were to be approved. He also told the BBC that Russia has increased gas supplies to Western Europe and cited two different figures, an increase of both 10% and 15%. Asked if Russia is withholding supplies for political reasons, the ambassador said, "Certainly we do not withhold it for political reasons." He said Russia has increased gas supply to Western Europe through Ukraine by 10%, but added that the pipeline cannot increase capacity further. He said the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is ready to operate and that he expects Germany will give the new pipeline the go-ahead. A new 764-mile pipeline runs across the Baltic Sea to Germany, bypassing Ukraine, but has sparked opposition from the United States and many Eastern European countries worried about energy security and climate goals. Ambassador Andrei Kelin's comments follow claims that Russia has been limiting gas supplies in a bid to prod regulators in Europe into moving quickly to certify their controversial new pipeline Nord Stream 2. Last week, Government Minister Lord Agnew of Alton said spiralling energy costs were nothing to do with supply shortages, but were due to a geopolitical move by Russia to put pressure on Europe. Challenged by BBC journalist Andrew Marr that there is no evidence in publicly available data that Russia has increased supply through Ukraine by 10%, Andrei Kelin said he is not a specialist in that area, but added, gas travels at not the speed of light, of course, it goes very slowly by that. So what do you expect? Once the president has said we will supply more gas and tomorrow prices will go down. This is not possible. asked if Russia is doing everything it can to get more and cheaper gas to Western Europe. Ambassador Kellin said Nord Stream 2 would help to address those issues, and asked if it is gas supplies will increase from 1st of November, whether or not Nord Stream 2 is granted approval. Ambassador Kellin said, "I simply do not know, but we have, as I said, we increase it by 15% right now." Elsewhere in the interview, the Russian ambassador insisted that BBC journalist Sarah Rainsford, who was expelled from Russia earlier this year, can return to the country if visas are granted to Russian journalists to work in Britain. Meanwhile, Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said on Saturday, 16th of October, that Russian gas consumption is running at a record high, but Moscow is still ready to increase supplies to Europe should it receive such requests. European spot gas prices have surged by 800% this year as demand has recovered after the coronavirus pandemic. Prices eased earlier this month after Russia, Europe's key gas supplier, said it could deliver more gas, but these supplies have yet to materialize. "I want to underline that we in Russia have record high gas consumption figures this year, which is also due to active economic recovery," Alexander Novak said in an interview with the Rossiya 1 TV channel broadcast, according to Russian news agencies. Russia, whose gas production and exports to the European Union are already near record highs, has said it needs to finish filling its own gas shortage reserves before it increases supplies to Europe's spot market. It plans to complete this by the end of October. Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak did not say how large Russia's gas reserves were, but estimated that European underground facilities were short of around 25 billion cubic meters of natural gas. He insisted high domestic demand would not stop Russia offering more gas supplies to Europe if it received such requests.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In case you've just joined us on this series of the show, we've been talking about the women in the life of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. In the studio with me, I have the privilege and honor of being accompanied by my darling sister, Sister Razia Shavni. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam, my sister, Sister Zainab.
Thank you for being with us.
So happy to be here to have a lovely conversation with you.
Inshallah ta'ala, likewise.
We're talking about the Prophet's appreciation towards women. We have the case of Fatima bint Asad, Imam Ali's mother,
Who raised him from childhood.
He says about her, "After Abi Talib, no one was kind to me as much as Fatima bint Asad, even kinder to him than her own children." He sees that. He acknowledges. So far, we were talking about the Prophet's conduct with the women. Had a Prophet started a timeless method or frame of view or, you know, world view about, you know, men's treatment of women, and not only that, but family life, parenting, spousal relationship, all that included, right? So one of the instances where we see in the life of the noble prophet is that he used to sometimes consult women who were around him. Because so many people say that women are not as smart as men, and you know, you shouldn't consult with them. You're in charge, do not even consider their opinion. But when you see the life of the prophet, you see that he used to sometimes ask women's opinion, in certain women, of course, women who had the talent that the noble prophet could refer to.
Exactly, who had worthy opinions.
Exactly. And we want to see whether there are instances in the noble Quran where women are consulted with by men, and whether it's okay or not. And there are two instances. For example, one is with regards to the topic of lactating and weaning children, and that is in chapter Baqarah, verse number 233, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells husbands and wives to consult each other with regards to the period of, you know, when to wean their children. That's one instance. The second instance, which is much more straightforward and clear, crystal clear, is with regards to Shu'aib's daughters.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That they were, mashallah, so tactful, so wise and knowledgeable, that the Quran, not only wise, knowledgeable, and, you know, they were also working, you know, they were employed, of course, not officially, but their father was an old man, and they were the ones who were taking care of the family's financial needs. They would, you know, take the animals, the sheep. They were shepherds, right? And in that society, in that, still in that culture, when we have the instance of them taking the sheep's, the herd, for watering them, and it was so patriarchic that the men wouldn't let them to approach the water,
to have access to the water,
right? And then Prophet Moses, he was witnessing the scene, and
he took care of it like a hero.
Exactly. He's like, why are you women standing in the back? First of all, because of their haya, their modesty, that they didn't want to mix in with men and, you know,
go shoulder to shoulder.
Exactly. And also because of the, obviously, the patriarchal, they didn't allow them to even come close and to, you know, it's like ladies, there was no ladies first, men first. So after seeing this, obviously, such women who are in the society, who have experienced being with men and working with them, and seeing instances of, and seeing Moses' behavior, mashallah, they had a very good analytical power, very smart women. They come to their father, and the way they had analyzed the behavior of Moses is very beautiful. They say, قالت إحداهما, one of the two women said, Ya Abati, father, استأجره, hire him, إن خير من استأجرت القوي الأمين. Indeed, the best you can hire is a powerful and trustworthy man. قوي الأمين. So because they have seen him.
And Nabi Musa alayhi wa sallam was really like freakishly strong. So strong he could kill someone with a single punch.
Yeah. Exactly. Not only that, but he was also trustworthy.
That's the perfect combination
of a good
worker, labor worker.
No, good husband. Because yes, in the hadith also, when someone comes to ask the imam's opinion, he says, give your daughter to someone who is amin, who is a good trust keeper.
Yes, exactly.
And they had realized that. And then Shu'aib himself offers one of his daughters,
proposes him on behalf of his daughter. More of that after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to Muslim Lady here in the studio. I'm with my darling sister Razia Shamili, and we're talking about the position of women in the life of Rasulullah. It was obvious from the conduct of Nabi Musa ala Nabino alayhi salam that, you know,
he saw these two women. They needed to get their business done. He offered his services. He helped them out. He walked them home without abusing them, assaulting them. He took care of the sheep. When they said, you walk in front of us so we wouldn't have to lead the way and you'd be checking us out from behind, he was like, okay, cool, that totally makes sense. I'll lead the way, even though I don't even know where your father lives, right? But but his conduct, like you said, it exuberated so much haya, so much trustworthiness, so much modesty, so much, okay, I feel safe around this man.
Exactly.
Right?
That they took him to their father.
Exactly.
These women who are so reserved,
yeah,
who stay back,
yeah,
and not go into, you know, mingle with men, they trust him so much that they say, come with us.
Exactly.
Follow us, we will take you to our home.
Yeah.
One of them ends up marrying him. So this is another instance of consulting women, where a prophet of a tribe listens to the opinion of his daughter, and it brings so much prosperity. It changes the fate of an ummah, right?
Mm.
This marriage and everything. And also, in the life of the noble prophet, we see that he used to consult some women, for one of which were
Umm Salama.
Also Lady Khadija, right? I think...
And Amir al-Mumin did so with Sayyidah Fatima, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Definitely.
Mm.
There is one part of Nahj al-Balagha where Amir al-Mumin, alayhi salam, says that, do not load women with that which does not concern them. So we have to always have a balance in life. When it says, ar-rajal qawwamun, at the same time, you do your consultation, you act democratically, you ask their opinion in the fields that they have specialty, but don't put too much, don't burden them with more than they can
handle.
And this is good for their beauty. If you want a fresh...
If you want to preserve that beauty, that youth, that...
Jubilance?
Yes, exactly. It's best for you not to stress her out so much. Don't give her sass. Don't give her drama. It's not good for her skin. Support her in
your
her endeavor.
Skin.
It's not good for your skin at all. She
happy
will slay you.
Happy wife, happy life, right? And about Lady Khadija, we can say that the noble prophet, of course, became a prophet when he was with her.
Yes.
Right, so that big revelation, that big revolution happened when he was with her.
Yeah.
Right? That mission, it was so heavy, such a burden, such a hard burden. First of all, that the noble prophet, you know, receiving the wahy was very, very difficult for him. And also so worried. He was so worried that, would people listen to me?
Exactly.
I'm going to go to these people. And obviously, it took 3 years for him. First, his ashira wa andar ashirat kal aghrabin, and then little by little by little, he made the whole public, you know, he openly declared his prophethood.
Yeah.
So all that stress, but he had by him a very understanding wife. Right?
Someone said something really interesting to me a while back. She said to me that men grow with stress while women break in stress. And I found it very interesting. And when I really looked at it, except, you know, where certain circumstances where there's an exception in everything. We're not talking about that. But in general, generally speaking about it, men, they go out to the world. They stress themselves out. They need to, you know, analyze life and assess different aspects of it and deal with bankruptcy and money and finance and economy and politics and this and that and all that just grinds them. And nurtures them into better people. But if women have to deal with that, well, first of all, acne, their skin will break out. Men, no matter how busy he is, the moment his head hits the pillow, he's out.
He's gone.
Yeah, like a light. But women, they'll stay up all night and they'll let it eat them up on the inside, you know? So when she said that to me, again, exceptions aside, I felt like, you're right. Let him go out and be stressed. I'll be here. And act as his refuge, exactly, as his refuge, as his anchor, as his safe place.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is, englishradio@irib.ir.
that when you're saying these, it's like so far away from the reality.
Exactly.
Of the world.
It's far from practical.
I'm looking at my own life. It's the case with many, many women out there, especially in the West. Because still in some Muslim countries, men carry out the burden for the family. But in many parts of Europe, for example, women are like brave-hearted men, putting their chest straight forward to all the hardships and challenges of life. It hits them. And they actually, I don't know if this is what they really like or if they've been brought up to act like this. These need to be studied and analyzed in its own place and time. I was just going to say one sentence about the relationship between Lady Khadija Salamullah alayha and the Noble Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi wa alayhi wa sallam. Look at her view. If only, you know, men love their wives to praise them, to understand them. They're going under so much hardship. They want their wives to actually acknowledge it. In the same way that women like men to acknowledge what they do, it's a two-sided street. So Khadija, we used to say, Muhammad, know that Allah will not leave you alone. You've never abandoned serving your family. You've always been a family man. You've been perfect. And observing the bonds of your relationship, your kinships, right? You've never hurt anyone and have never refrained from assisting others. Look at the high esteem that Lady Khadija had regarding her beloved husband.
And how much she validates and acknowledges him and his virtues.
And accepts his authority.
Yeah.
One thing that men love to have. Some people say, if you want to be the queen, make your husband the king first, you'll be the queen.
Unfortunately, we have all out of time for today's discussion of Muslim Lady, but inshallah, more of that on further episodes here on IRIB English Radio. Until then, I leave you all in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something. Something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. I wish that some. Tell me out of love that on that day I'll be okay.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The claim that U.S. drones are humane and effective has always been a lie. But by classifying the program as top secret and by aggressively prosecuting whistleblowers, the United States has been able to hide the truth about drones from most Americans. We'll prepare for you an article written by Leonard C. Goodman, a Chicago criminal defense lawyer and co-owner of the newly independent Chicago-based weekly Reader. The piece is titled U.S. Killer Drone Program Stays Afloat on Sea of Lies. The article has been published by the Asia Times. On 29th of August, in the final days of its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan, the United States launched a drone strike, firing a 20-pound Hellfire missile at an aid worker named Zamari Ahmadi as he parked his car outside of his home in a residential neighborhood of Kabul, Afghanistan's capital. The strike killed Mr. Ahmadi and 9 members of his family, including 7 children, 5 of whom were younger than 10 years old. The children had come outside to meet Mr. Ahmadi as he returned home from his job at a non-governmental organization where he distributed food to Afghans displaced by the war and occupation. When a surviving member of Mr. Ahmadi's family complained publicly about the errant airstrike, the U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, did what it has been doing for the past 20 years in Afghanistan. It simply lied. According to the New York Times, the Pentagon claimed that Mr. Ahmadi was a facilitator for Daesh terrorist group and that his car was packed with explosives, posing an imminent threat to U.S. occupation forces guarding the evacuation at Kabul airport. General Kenneth McKenzie, commander of the U.S. Central Command, claimed a drone strike dealt Daesh terrorists a crushing blow. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, called it a righteous strike. When it was confirmed that Afghan children as young as 2 years old had died in the strike, the Pentagon claimed that any civilian deaths resulted from the detonation of explosives inside the vehicle that was targeted. The U.S. military produced a wrong assessment that the occupants of the vehicle were wearing suicide vests and that the car itself was packed with explosives. Most U.S. drone strikes take place in remote areas, and no follow-up investigation is ever conducted. However, the slaughter of Mr. Ahmadi's family took place 3 kilometers from Kabul airport, at which American reporters were stationed covering the chaotic evacuation of U.S. occupation forces and allies from Kabul airport. In the days following the deadly drone strike, reporters from the New York Times conducted a thorough investigation, visiting Mr. Ahmadi's home and place of work, viewing video footage from his security cameras, and consulting with weapons experts. This investigation quickly confirmed that every official statement from the Pentagon was false. Mr. Ahmadi did not visit a Daesh safe house on the day of his death. He visited his office. His car was not loaded with explosives. It was loaded with water canisters that he was bringing home to his family because there was a water shortage in his neighborhood. After the publication of the New York Times investigation, the U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, conceded that it had made a tragic but honest mistake when it assassinated Mr. Ahmadi and members of his family in a drone strike. No one has been held accountable for a deadly mistake. Targeted drone killing is an innovation of the so-called war on terror. It facilitates continuous war by making it appear less costly and more humane. Indeed, President Biden has already announced that the United States will continue launching drone strikes from afar after its withdrawal from Afghanistan. similar language was used when President Biden announced an end to American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, while reserving the right to continue killing Yemenis if it believes they are linked to Daesh or Al-Qaeda terrorists. And of course, don't expect any peace dividends from the end of the war in Afghanistan. In September, the U.S. House of Representatives approved in bipartisan fashion $778 billion in military spending for 2022, a $37 billion increase over the 2021 military budget. More than half of the funds American taxpayers have sent to the Pentagon since 11th of September 2001, about $8 trillion, has ended up in the pockets of private corporations such as Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. These companies then use some of those taxpayer dollars to lobby Congress and the President to keep the wars going and the money flowing in into their pockets. The late U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower warned of the danger that a profit-seeking military-industrial complex would produce a state where wars are not fought with an intention of winning them, but to ensure that they never end. British author George Orwell articulated these dangers in his classic novel, 1984, wherein he described continuous war as an opaque, low-intensity conflict whose primary purpose was to siphon off resources and perpetuate itself. Begun under George W. Bush, the drone program was fully embraced and escalated under the presidencies of Barack Obama and Donald Trump. Barack Obama assured Americans that U.S. drones are so exceptionally surgical and precise, narrowly targeted against those who want to kill us, while not putting innocent men, women, and children in danger. The claim that drones are humane and effective has always been a lie. But by classifying the program as top secret and by aggressively prosecuting whistleblowers, the United States has been able to hide the truth from the American public. Ironically, of course, the people targeted by U.S. drone strikes know the truth about who is being killed. Thus, the classification of all information about drones does nothing to protect national security. Rather, it protects government officials from any accountability. I have asked several members of the U.S. Senate about the drone program and have never received a straight answer from them. In the autumn of 2009, I attended a fundraiser for Senator Chuck Schumer at a Chicago law firm. The United States has just suffered one of its deadliest months in Afghanistan, in which more than 50 Americans were killed. Senator Chuck Schumer assured the group that Barack Obama was turning things around with his unmanned killer drone program. I asked Senator Schumer about civilian deaths and whether the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, which then ran the drone program, had ever studied whether drones killed more terrorists than they created. The senator claimed he was pretty sure that the CIA did reach such a conclusion. In fact, as WikiLeaks later revealed, the CIA had conducted such a study in July of 2009. But that study, called CIA Best Practices in Counterinsurgency, reached the opposite conclusion: that the clandestine drone and assassination program was likely to produce counterproductive outcomes, including strengthening the very extremist groups that it was allegedly designed to destroy, particularly if non-combatants are killed in the attacks. This report was classified as secret, meaning it could be read by Senator Chuck Schumer, but not by you or me, until 2014, when WikiLeaks released it to the public. others have come forward to expose the official lies told about the drone program. In 2014, a former signals intelligence analyst in the U.S. Air Force named Daniel Hale leaked internal documents exposing how, in 1 5-month period in Afghanistan, 90% of the people killed by U.S. drone strikes were not the intended targets. Daniel Hale also disclosed how children in areas targeted by U.S. drones cannot go out and play on clear days because that is when the drones fly. Daniel Hale said that drone operators reported having to kill a part of their conscience to keep doing their job. Hale was prosecuted under the Espionage Act for leaking these documents and has been sentenced to 45 months in prison. The investigation by the New York Times into the drone assassination of Mr. Ahmadi and his family is an important step in bringing some sunlight into the clandestine world of drone warfare. Sadly, most victims of U.S. drone strikes remain anonymous, as the strikes take place in remote areas of faraway countries such as Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya. Much of the work to reveal the truth about drones still falls on independent investigative journalists and whistleblowers like Daniel Hale. They are our best hope to begin holding those responsible accountable and bringing an end to this dangerous lie.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.